The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the City Bible Forum. It's great to have you here. I've met a few people I haven't met before, so a special welcome for you if it's your first time, and of course a great welcome to all of our regular attendees. We had a little bit of a disaster this week. The fellow who was supposed to speak, Tor Lu, unfortunately became quite ill and couldn't speak for us today. But as it happens, Ian Powell, who is on staff at the City Bible Forum, was available, and he's agreed to speak on the same passage of the Bible that that Tor was aiming to speak on. So I doubt, though, that Tor and Ian will give you the same twist on the Bible. I think you might find it slightly different if you ever hear Tor speak, and hopefully you will next week, of course. For that, because there are a few new people here, let me just explain very briefly what we're about and what's about to happen, just so that, you know, there's no surprises. What we're about is, I guess, we want to combat, if you like, a great deal of lack of knowledge about the Bible, and particularly amongst city workers. And so we put it on a forum in a public place where people, where we read a bit of the Bible, we discuss it, and hopefully that leads to a higher understanding of what the Bible's about, and particularly who Jesus is and what he's about. So I hope that's what you were hoping to get. Otherwise, please just grab a piece of pizza, and I hope you enjoy the next 40 minutes anyway. We just have some pizza on at the back. If you need something to eat, just a $5 donation would be helpful. Or if you just need a drink, please grab yourself a complimentary soft drink. What will happen is I'll read this part of the Bible. It's printed on these sheets that should be on the table in front of you. I'll read that. Ian will speak to us, maybe 20, 25 minutes. And at the end of that time, he'll open the floor to questions. You'll need to call them out because it's a big room, unfortunately. But we love people's comments, questions. And even if you disagree with something Ian said, we're happy to take those sorts of questions. We think the wider the range of ideas that are expressed, the more interesting the meeting becomes. So, yeah. Without any further ado, I'll read and hand over to Ian. Now, this is Paul. He's writing to a church in Corinth. So we're getting one half of a conversation, and I'm sure Ian will explain that in context in a few minutes. So let me read this passage for us. For Christ did not send me, Paul, to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom and eloquence, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us, Christians, that is, who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where are the wise? Where is the wise? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. It's a stumbling block to Jews and it's foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Brothers and sisters, listen to what you were... Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards, nor many influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of the world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God, that is, our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let those who boast, boast in the Lord. Thank you, Ian.
Well, Ken will also give you your money back if you came hoping to hear Tor, because it is a bit of accidental false advertising. He'd actually be a really good bloke to get to speak about suffering, because Tor lives with an amount of sickness for a young man that's really seems so unfair. And He's in hospital at the moment because of medication for something else that caused him to bleed internally. But the plan is that he'll speak next week. Now, I watched with my daughter the other day what I think is a very clever movie called Mean Girls. And there's a lovely expression that gets used a few times when this new girl to the school thinks about doing something. And two different groups at various times use this phrase. They say, don't do that, or don't join the maths club, for example, because that would be social suicide. And that's a lovely expression, but you could see the look of terror that it rightly and expectedly produced in the young woman. To do something which in your social setting, the people who you hope to become a part of, we just instinctively like to be respected by people we work with or meet with socially, to do something that would be social suicide means to do something that would show you to be just wrong, to be stupid, to be straight, to be weak, to be pathetic, to be a loser, to be on the outside. And one of the interesting things I think it would have been for the Apostle Paul when he, to his own surprise, became a Christian, having been the first organizer of deliberate persecution of the church and then sort of had this terrible shock and became a Christian, would have been the fact that although he was we can see he's a highly educated man, both in the Jewish tradition of the scriptures and in the Greek tradition of logic and rhetoric and things like that, he had a message that, as you heard here, instinctively or instantly produces the response in people, what a stupid message. And if I bring to you a message that in your own plausibility structures in the universe that you've been educated into is self-evidently stupid, but I seem to be believing it, and I'm bringing this to you because I want you to believe it, but you know for all sorts of reasons this is a dumb message. This is a self-evidently false message. What sort of opinion do you have of me? Well, obviously I'm a fool, aren't I? I mean, if I've been convinced by something that on the first view you can tell to be ridiculous, what sort of a moron am I? And I'm a proud man, frankly, and I don't mind you disagreeing with me, but I don't want you to think I'm stupid. I realize for me that's one of the things I hate the most. Disagree with me, that's fine, I can cope with that. That's what adults do, we disagree respectfully. But don't dismiss me as a moron. Obnoxious. I'd rather you dismiss me as someone who's obnoxious than someone who's just plain stupid. But the problem with true Christianity is, from the very beginning, it has been to a large percentage of the human race self-evidently ridiculous. And it's not a thing that is just because we've become better educated, that our learning has reached the point that we look back at stuff that the early Christians believed and we go, well, they would believe that, wouldn't they? I mean, they really were pretty primitive compared to us. So you can see that if you have a look at the passage that is printed out there for you, perhaps at verse 18, the second little number there, it says, the message of the cross, that is the message that the apostle brought, the message of Jesus, he summarizes, the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. They just hear it and they know this is implausible. This is ridiculous. And this is back, what, about 50 or so AD. And people will still hear the message of Jesus and his death and they will instinctively know this is a silly message. I don't mind a bit of conversation about spirituality and God, but please don't ask me to believe that the central thing God has ever done in history is the execution of just one more Jew outside of one more city, which is what in the end the Apostle Paul comes to Corinth saying, I've got really important news for you from the God who made the universe, and it's all to do with a guy being crucified. Because that is just self-evidently stupid. And he then divides the sort of opposition to the idea into two main categories. And I think although they might have different titles now, we'll find two similar sorts of rejections and reasons for rejection in our own day. You might look at yourself and say, yes, I'm more like the Jews than the Greeks, or I'm more like the Greeks than the Jews, or I once was like the Greeks, or I once was like the Jews. You might be a Greek by descent, but actually reject Christianity because of the reason in the first century the Jews did. So let's not worry too much about the titles. Let's have a look at the arguments. So this message of Jesus is just ridiculous, but very different criteria. Have a look at verse 22. Sentence 22 and 23, he says, Jews demand signs, And Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. So it's not as if the apostle is unaware of how unacceptable his message is. But he thinks in the end this is the most important and the most powerful and the wisest message ever spoken on the planet. But those who are brought up in what he calls the Jewish mindset, as he had been, they're not interested in the message of someone dying. They're interested in what? What's going to convince them something's true and real and significant and important? Signs. That is, miracles. They want to see something. They want to see a demonstration that God is great. They want to see the power that they see in God when he first makes the universe. And that central act in Jewish history where God sort of blows apart the Egyptian Empire and releases his people by a great demonstration of his power, where God sort of flexes his arm, as the Bible says, and stretches out his hand and redeems and rescues his people by great, obvious, miraculous power. You can see the reality of God. It's actually the basis, Professor Edwin Judge thinks, it's the basis of the Western culture's appreciation for experiment. That you see things are true by things that you can observe. And they want to see something. So they want to see some demonstration that God is at work powerfully. Then we'll believe maybe we should listen, as he did with Moses. But what does Paul come and tells him? Well, he summarized it as the message of the cross. Or in chapter 2, verse 2, he says, we preach Christ crucified. A message of weakness. A message about a man who gets executed, of a leader who gets overpowered by the Romans. Not very powerful, in fact, self-evidently weak and pathetic. Moses was not crucified by the Pharaoh. Right? In the end, God was at work through Moses, so it was a great act of power. That's what impresses the Jews. And what they get is a message of a man being crucified. And that's why in the next verse, verse 23, he says, this message of Christ crucified is a stumbling block to Jews. They say, this is the thing that makes them fall over. That is, they just can't travel with the Apostle Paul because it's just wrong. This just can't be God if in the end his great man gets crucified. Because great men with God are supposed to found empires and lead armies and do stuff like that. So the Apostle Paul knows that his own national group, the Jews, when they hear the message that he's been given about the crucified Jesus, they're going to go, that's just silly. That's just not what God does. God is powerful. God is great. Caught up in some grotty, filthy execution of some historic loser. And then the Greeks, on the other hand, they were, and it's hard for us to take this seriously, I think, and I've only learnt this in the last few months listening to this huge intellect of Edwin Judge. He's been saying, he's got all this evidence that indicates that what the Greeks were convinced about was not at all evidence. Because they thought very lightly what you could see and touch. The way that you got in touch with what was true and ultimate was thought, reason, logic. That's the thing. You don't go and experiment. In fact, about the 3rd century, one of the great Greek doctors speaks disparagingly of the doctors from what he calls the school of Moses and Christ, who engage in experiment, who engage in watching what happens. No, he says the way to work out the best sort of medicine is to think, because the world of thought is the world of the eternal. So this is what he says here, that Greeks are looking for wisdom, that is, fine argument, with all the appropriate sort of flourishes of rhetoric and eloquence that the Apostle Paul had been taught to do in Tarsus, where he grew up. He knew how to do that. He'd been through the Greek schooling system as well as the Jewish one. But he knew what they wanted. They wanted something that was beautiful and balanced and theoretical, that made sense, that you could sort of draw it, if you like, intellectually. And there was this beautiful system. Ah, yes. The eternal, unchanging world of truth. The eternal, unchanging world of that which endures. That's wisdom. That's where you find the truth. And yet, what is the message that the Apostle Paul brings? The message Here's God's greatest, most powerful work. Let me tell you about a man called Jesus who got crucified outside Jerusalem. I mean, it wasn't even outside Athens or even Sparta, or at least that was a good military center. But surely if the gods were going to do anything, it would be in Athens. Jerusalem, for crying out loud. That is Hicksville. You know, God's done his greatest work just outside of Dubbo. I mean, seriously, you know, you're kidding. It's impossible. But that's what he's asking them to believe. So he says in the end that self-evidently the Christian message is just silly. And the difficult thing for the Apostle Paul is, like all the early Christians, they knew it. They knew that as they took the message to the world, the best news that the world was ever going to hear, that two of the leading groups, those who thought in the way of the Greeks, the cleverest, the best educated people on the planet at that stage probably, they were just going to think this is just pathetic and foolish. And the Jews were going to say, well, man, whatever's happening here, it's not God. Because surely if God was caught up with Jesus, he'd be like Moses and not like a loser, which a man who's crucified is obviously. So these are the two different ways that people heard the message and thought, Paul, you seem like a moderately intelligent guy, but you're believing something that is weak and foolish. You've chosen to identify with something that we know is shameful. Now, you'll know that there is at least one other large religion in the world today that has a generally respectful position of Jesus, but will get quite indignant on his behalf when you speak to them about the crucifixion of Jesus. Because they will say, God would never let that happen to someone as wonderful as Jesus. And when I've talked with them and read the literature, they actually think Christians are being blasphemous and we are dishonouring God and angering God by saying Jesus was crucified. Because as the first century Jews, which the Apostle Paul was one of, they know that whatever God's doing, it's got nothing to do with crucifixions. So that's the first thing, that the message then and now is silly. So it's helpful, I think, to remember that if you find yourself hearing the Christian message and thinking, that can't be really what God wants to talk to me about, Kenneth, a man being crucified naked in shame, by all means struggle with it, but whatever you think, it's not because you're modern, it's not because you're more cultured, it's not because we're better educated, it's just a classic human response to this very strange story that is at the heart of Jesus, which is that he comes to do his best and biggest thing for us in by being crucified. So that's the first thing. The message really does seem ridiculous on at least two different accounts. Now, secondly, why then does the Apostle Paul and all the early Christians insist on this message of the cross? You read the letter of 1 Peter and probably three of the greatest passages in the whole of the Bible about the death of Jesus are found in 1 Peter. He's as obsessed about the death of Jesus as anybody else. This is just what they go on about. Well, the reason why they keep going on about it, the reason why authentic modern-day Christians will keep going on about the death of Jesus is because it is actually where God does his most powerful and most wonderful work. If you've done any study of communication, I've done a tiny little bit, not much. There's a very important phrase about the sovereignty of the audience. You know, basically, if the audience don't like what they're hearing, they turn off. Or if they don't like the person who's presenting it, they just stop listening. And if it's the television with the little control, bang, you know, you've gone. You cease to exist. You're no longer speaking. Because you're polite, you may have decided 5 minutes ago, this guy's an idiot, but you might hang in there for the remaining 7 or 8 minutes because you'd be well brought up, etc. But the audience is sovereign at one level. But if you come with real solid truth, or what you believe to be real, solid, enduring truth that the audience needs to hear, you may continue to try to communicate the message that their first response is to dismiss or to deny. And that's what the apostle is saying here. And he goes on and says, let me read you those verses again, and then here's how he keeps on going. Verse 22. Jews demand signs, acts of power. Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified. A stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. It's not just that Paul is a psychopath and likes fighting with people. There are just some times when the audience is saying, we don't want to hear that, I don't want to hear that, please. Now, I've actually had people, I was at Sydney High School once time doing a sort of a high school seminar, and some of the guys saying, we don't want to hear that. It was funny, this guy was almost putting his hands over his ears, we don't want to hear that. He said, tell us about, and he gave me the subject he wanted me to talk about. And I said, no, you're not ready to hear about that until you've heard this. And it was you rarely get the bluntness of it, but I remember him going, no, he didn't quite go like that, that would have been foolish. But he just didn't want to hear it. But what the Apostle Paul is saying, I know that for the Jews, this is a silly message, Jesus dying. I know that for the Greeks, there's nothing impressive about the eloquence or the sources cited or anything like that, but this is actually how God does his powerful, wise work in saving people and bringing them to know him. So he says, we preach Christ crucified. Could he summarize the message any more offensively? Particularly if you're Jewish, I had the great pleasure, kind of a pleasure. I had a few weeks off and finally got round to reading Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great. He is a magnificent writer. The arguments were not all that impressive, but the writing is just beautiful. His grip on the language, his knowledge of various bits of human history. He's got almost a photographic memory like his brother does. So it was an interesting read. But he made a very odd mistake at one point. He made one or two mistakes, in my humble opinion. I'm glad he's not here to argue with me, but I think you can argue with a book because you put it out there in public, so it's fair enough to at least try to honestly and fairly argue with him. But he talks about a particularly interesting character from about 400, 500 years ago who claimed to be the Messiah. He was of Jewish origin and then claimed that he was going to lead Islam and Judaism and Christianity all together. And in the end, he went to Constantinople, Istanbul, and got put in prison. And he said the very wise Islamic ruler decided not to kill him. Otherwise, it would have been another whole religion, because that's how you start religions. I thought, wrong. You've shown so little understanding of history. You might know that in the first century in Palestine, where Jesus was, there were a number of messianic movements, people who claimed to be the Christ, the Messiah, the long-awaited king. Some of them we've only discovered in the last 40 years because we've dug it up archaeologically. Do you know what brought every single one of them to the end? The Romans killed, normally by crucifixion, the leader. And here's the thing that the Jews know. If someone claims to be the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed king, God's great ruler and leader, the one thing that can't happen to him is he cannot be crucified. Right? So it's like saying, this was the team that were the champions with the wooden spoon. You think, no, you can't come last and be undefeated. It's just a contradiction. It's like saying, this is a triangular circle. If you understand, no, it can't be, that's just a silly comment, right? You can't be the Christ that is crucified. You can't be God's great king who gets put to death in classic Jewish thought. It's the great proof that he isn't. But Paul says, I keep preaching. I, as a Jew, educated as a Greek, keep preaching this ridiculous message that God's great son was slaughtered. He said, because in the end, that's God's great way of saving people and changing people. And he says, he is determined not to embroider, not to fillet, not to improve, not to censor the message so that people won't be offended. Now, friends, this is a constant temptation for people who are Christians, to try and not say things that might offend people. Now, we do it for two reasons. We do it out of love for the person we're talking to. Christians, they want people who don't know Jesus to get to know him and to learn how trustworthy he is and to begin to follow him and find all the joy and the suffering that's caught up in that new way of life. So we do it out of love. We don't want to put a big roadblock in people's way. But we also do it out of self-love. We don't want to be a goose. We don't want to be the sort of person who believes silly things. So the word that Jesus uses a number of times is shame. You might remember if you read through the Gospels, a number of times Jesus speaks of the danger of being ashamed of me and my words. Because he knows in the end that we will often feel ashamed. Although when we stop and think objectively, we think, hang on, what is there about Jesus to be ashamed of? There's much about me to be ashamed of. There's much about my life I don't want you to know about because I'd be ashamed or embarrassed because you would think badly of me. What is there about Jesus to be ashamed of? Plenty. Because shame is not something that comes actually from the thing itself. It comes from people's perspective of it. And it's because if you hold the view that Jesus holds, remember what happened to Jesus. Right? It's always worthwhile remembering what happened to Jesus Christ. He was crucified. His own people, I would suggest the noblest religion on the planet, the leaders of the noblest religion on the planet, the only great monotheistic faith on the earth, worked hard to kill him for a number of years. And the Romans, who had the finest justice system the world had ever seen till then, their system conspired with Jesus' own people in order to put him to death. There is something deeply troubling about Jesus, both then and now. So whenever people feel, if you're a Christian and you feel a bit embarrassed to identify yourself, this is not a new problem. It's an ancient problem. It goes back to the very beginning. This temptation to embroider, to fix up. I felt it a number of times. I remember I was speaking at a youth camp and this guy who was there won't bore you with the details. He'd come with someone else. He was the founder of the Macquarie Uni Atheist Club. And he comes and I'm giving a talk that night. It was the only talk that in that 10 days on hell. And I'm thinking, oh, great. This great philosopher comes in and I'm terrifying children about hell. This is like a send-up of what Christians do, isn't it? And I'm kind of saying, oh, God, please make him get sick and run out and vomit. Don't let him hear this. This will be really unhelpful. A couple of years later, I was speaking. There was this lady dropped in who was a cellist. And she was everything I wasn't. She was attractive, she was cultured, she'd traveled the world, and I'd had about a half an hour conversation with her, and I was just aware that, you know, I was a big, grotty person in the presence of an extremely cultured person. And she, what am I? I'm doing a talk on the death of Jesus. And it was about sin and God's dislike of sin and how God's sin, our sin gets placed on Jesus and Jesus takes our punishment. And I was praying, God, please get her out of here. Let her come back tomorrow when I'm speaking slightly more philosophically. Both those conversations, to my surprise, the bloke, the atheist, the cellist, both of them became Christians. In those talks, when I'm praying, God, please get them out of the room. Because I was embarrassed to be talking about that stuff in the presence of culture. I know very little about what's useful for people. What the Apostle Paul says here is, this message is the power of God. If anything's going to change people, it's this message. So what we need to do, wherever we're at in our understanding of Christianity, is to embrace the weirdness of it. If humans made this religion up, it would make good, obvious sense to you. But this is a very strange religion, Christianity. The heart of it is the message of Christ crucified. We learn in the end that the significant thing about the main man in this religion is not what he says, as in Islam. The significant thing about Muhammad is not Muhammad, it's the Quran. As in Buddhism, the significant thing about Buddhism is not the Buddha, but the Dharma that he brings. Exactly not that in Christianity. The apostles didn't go preaching the Sermon on the Mount. They went around preaching about the cross of Jesus and how he died. They're going to say, if you want to understand the wisdom of God, the insight, the brilliance, the cleverness of God, the place to look is at the man being nailed up outside Jerusalem. You want to understand the most powerful act God has ever done in human history, where the greatest enemies of humankind are destroyed? Have a look at that man dying in apparent weakness. The most important thing that you can do as a human being is to not do anything. It's to stop trying to appease God, to stop trying to please God, and to trust someone else to do it for you in Jesus. That's the most important thing you do, is actually to stop trying and to trust someone else to do the work for you. But even then it says it's not even your faith that's the important thing. The really important thing in Christianity is not my faith in Jesus, it's his faithfulness to us. It's his reliability. And we discover, for example, as this verse talks about people being saved. People think that's a common religious term. It's not. Right? Muhammad is not your savior. This is not disrespectful at all. Muslims do not speak about Muhammad as being a savior. No one saves you. Perhaps Allah, what you do is you obey. Your books get marked, you get a dash of mercy, you might get in. There's certainly no salvation in Buddhism. Right? You save yourself. Christianity is weird. We think it's normal. It's not normal. It's about God rescuing us. This is not what the religions of the world ever teach, except Jesus. And then it says, what's the most important human action? Well, apart from faith, which is a non-action, it's not about religious cleansing, which is so central in many religious practices. It's not about sacred space that you need to get to sometime in your life. It's not about foods that you do or don't eat. The really significant thing is love, right? And especially the love of the enemy. It's learning to be like God, who, you know, which is about love. And so I could go on, but there's the weirdness about Christianity. The moral teaching of Jesus is acknowledged and honoured so long as people don't read it. Like the man who said to me once, I think Jesus is a great moral teacher, except for that rubbish about turning the other cheek. So I said, let me get this right. He's a great moral teacher, except when he disagrees with you. Well, who needs that? And he's saying, I'm the great moral teacher. I can judge Jesus' foolishness. Of course you don't turn the other cheek. If someone whacks you on the cheek, you whack them hard so they don't do it again. Right? You take revenge. So, friends, but in conclusion, before we throw it open for questions, what this passage is saying, and what I think Tor might have been touching on perhaps more succinctly and clearly than I was going to, is Christianity proclaims as its central bit of news the execution of a criminal. That's what the cross was for. It wasn't just for people who, you know, hadn't paid their parking fines. It was for the scum of the scum. And it says, that's the most beautiful, the most powerful, the most important event. Then and now, it will seem foolish and silly. And it's easy for humans to be ashamed of it or to rewrite Christianity in a way that we think will be more acceptable. Now, I've spoken for well long enough. Do you want to ask a question, make a statement, disagree? This is a world in which this is one of the places where we can disagree without, you know, squabbling nastily about things. What would you like to say? That's an interesting question I've never thought of, so I'm speculating. I'm presuming, is he coming back having died like last time and risen, or is this coming for the first time? Oh, well, I don't know quite exactly what he'd say. He wouldn't say the same thing as he said when he was teaching before his crucifixion, because he keeps on alluding to the fact that the big work is still to come. And then he dies, and he chooses not to make any public appearances. He appears to some unbelievers, like his brothers, and like the Apostle Paul, but he appears in to groups of no more than 500, and seems to be setting up the army for its next bit of loving endeavour. I don't know what he'd say. I don't imagine it would be. I suppose the reason why he hasn't come back and won't come back till his final return as judge is because it's our job now to point people to what he's done, to prepare them for the one final act that he says is to come, which is his return, not this time as judge, not this time killable or even ignorable, but as the judge who will judge the living and the dead. Do you want to come back? Have I missed your question? One of the things that Jesus is constantly doing, and we were having a discussion about this in a meeting yesterday, he constantly is responding to people's direct questions. So there are some issues that Jesus deals with, like the way that he teaches about divorce and remarriage, because I spoke about that on the weekend at a church in the west of Sydney. What's really the east of Sydney now? Is it Marylands, which is actually on the eastern half of Sydney, I think. Where Jesus is clearly engaging in, there's a debate raging amongst the rabbis of his day about what's legitimate grounds for divorce, and Jesus joins in that debate and comes out on one side, in fact, tougher than either side. So often he's engaging in debates that were happening, and that's why I think, so as a Jew, so Jesus spent almost all his time, as a child he was a refugee in Egypt, but in terms of his public teaching, all except a couple of days, he's in Jewish territory. So he's answering Jewish questions, which is why there are a series of questions that don't come up. See, some people say Jesus doesn't care about it because he doesn't talk about it. That's nonsense. It's just not an issue amongst the Jews. So he never condemns child sacrifice, common enough in the religions of the world, because the Old Testament has dealt with that and the Jews aren't concerned about it. But he has to deal with shabby divorce stuff that the Jewish men were doing in order to trade their old wives in on fresh ones. He comments on that. So I would think he would probably come, and if he was going to talk, you know, I'm an Anglican, if he was going to talk to Anglicans, he'd probably, you know, lovingly slap us around the head about a few things. And we'd all think he'd be slapping everyone else around the head, but he'd have some pretty strong things to say to me, I think. In the same way as my doctor, John Best, has said some pretty strong things to me about my health. You know, and I understand, I had another doctor who called me morbidly obese. And I said, gee, that's one of the nicest things I've ever had said to me. But I know he said it to me because he loved me. So I don't know exactly what Jesus would talk to us about. I've got hunches. But Jesus is really big on, while you're busy being critical of that person, have a look at yourself. So what he would say about work, slavery, other stuff, we can deduce. I think that's what Christians are often doing. They're saying, well, he doesn't talk about... So when I became a Christian, I was from a group that took all sorts of drugs. We'd moved on from alcohol to other much more interesting drugs. And I didn't want to believe... I knew I couldn't get drunk because the Bible was clear. Don't tell my daughters this. I run on a neither confirm nor deny policy with my daughters. But I didn't want to believe that I couldn't take these other drugs, which I thought in many ways are more sociable anyhow than alcohol. You didn't vomit and get in fights with them. And so I spent a few months playing games. I knew I couldn't get drunk, which was not all that hard then. But what about the other drugs? Well, in the end, I worked out whatever the reasons why God doesn't want me to get drunk, the sort of brain, he wants me to meet the world as it is, I think. I take it for the same reasons for the other thing, apart from the rotten teaching in the Bible about obeying the government. So insofar as the government doesn't ask me to sin, I have to obey it. So I think that's what Christians do. We think, is there anything where God talks about this? This is the trouble with working out questions about some of the genetic questions. To ask, does the Bible give us any clue as to some of the... Because it doesn't talk about genetics as such, but it does talk about children, it does talk about in the womb and other stuff like that. I'm sorry if that's a bit of a vague... Should we stop there? I'm happy to hang around if you've got another question.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for filling in at the last minute. If you look on the sheet at the bottom, that's the topic there for next week. Tor will speak about... Well, we've heard about a man dying, and following a man who has been crucified as a criminal is strange enough, but what about this idea of rising from the dead? Surely that can't be true. Well, come and hear what Tor has to say about that. Now, I commented earlier that one of the things we attempt to achieve here at the City Bible Forum is to increase levels of biblical literacy. You can do that in a couple of ways. One is by reading An Essential Jesus, which is a biography of Jesus. You can read about his death and the reports of his resurrection. That might be interesting to you. Another thing you can do is on the desk, the tables in front of you, is we've got a bookmark here for the Center for Public Christianity, and they deal with a whole bunch of issues that are coming up in modern-day culture and addressing it from a biblical or a Christian perspective. So you might find that interesting. Of course, you can read about the City Bible Forum in these sheets. And there's an interesting little pamphlet here which explores the idea of what does it mean for this man to have died? What does that mean? It's entitled, When Will I Have Certainty? So that's one of the great selling points of the Christian gospel is certainty about where we stand before God. So if any of those are interesting, please take them with you. We'll see you next week. Thank you for your patronage.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.